This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Conflict is an essential part of the human condition, or so say many social scientists. Whether you agree with that or not, we are surrounded by conflicts, from the migrant crisis on our doorstep to the seemingly never-ending wars in the Middle East. So do we need a fresh approach to try to resolve these crises? My guest today says that his organization is trying precisely that. Alberto Gomez is the director of DEEP, which stands for Dialogue, Emphatic Engagement, and Peacebuilding Network. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
So could you tell us what DEEP Network is about?
Yes, indeed. It's always a pleasure to be on BFM, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on something I'm really very passionate about. DEEP stands for Dialogue, Empathic Engagement, and Peace Building, as you mentioned. And what the center or the network is involved in doing is setting up a kind of a space where we bring a number of very committed peace activists from different parts of the world to work on various kinds of projects. Ultimately, our goal is to establish conditions for ecological and a peaceful world. So the people that form DEEP are mainly young, scholar activists who have graduated from various peace masters programs in Spain, in Innsbruck in Austria, as well as in Mexico, and there are a number from Indonesia. And what a number of us have done is we have brought them together and set up this organization that's called the DEEP Network. It's in its infancy. It's just about a year old. We are in the process of building, but we hope that we will start to be fully operational in the next several months or so.
So is it fair to define it as sort of part NGO, part think tank, part lobbying organization? I mean, so you've gathered these people, what's the work that's currently being done?
Okay, you're absolutely right in the sense that it is part NGO, it is part a think tank. And what we hope to do, a lot of it is we focus on transformational sort of projects, and these projects are carried out at the local level, at community-based level. A number of us are academics, or we have training in academia, and we have in fact been researchers in peace building and conflict transformation. So what we are attempting to do is to bring together those young scholar activists who are full of energy, and we are in the process of harnessing this positive energy to bring them together with the people like myself. I'm much older, as you can see, and we are trying to set up this kind of exchange, intergenerational exchange, where we bring the young together with the older, more experienced, the young with the refreshing ideas and less jaded view of the world, and the older who seem to be a bit jaded but with the tremendous amount of experience, and we bring them together with the hope of developing various kinds of projects. But I should stress that we work with communities rather than for communities, or we impose our own ideas and values or theories on communities. So, and most of the communities that we work with are marginalized communities like refugees, and we also work with indigenous peoples in different parts of the world.
Whose opinions are you seeking to change, and what parties are you engaging in that effort to change opinion and to, shape policy?
We hope to change the opinion of everyone. So I think it is really important that in the world that we live in today, for example, we want to challenge a number of views and opinions that are considered to be natural. Take, for example, that today, people think that competition is a natural part of human life. We believe that cooperation is. So we want to try to, instill this value of cooperation among people. So we take another, concept that violence is very much part of, today's life, that people humans are innately aggressive. And we take the view, no, it's not true, because, humans have lived in peace, harmony, generally cohesive, societies for, a large part of human existence on this planet. So I don't see any reason why violence should be given that sort of prominence In fact, we argue that violence is an aberration and peace is the norm. So we want to try to change the mindsets of people. So that's why, you know, I say that would like to, you know, change everybody's view. Sometimes, you know, some would say that perhaps we should change the views of the leaders and we change the views of the politicians. Today we find in a world where, you know, leaders actually don't lead, you know. They are led by the polls and by the opinion, you know, surveys that. And so what we want to do now is that we would like to try as much as possible to educate people, you know, perhaps formally as well as informally. We want to try to change, you know, the thinking. We want to also challenge some of the dominant, you know, views and paradigms, especially in a, you know, neoliberal society, the focus on individual, you know, individualism, the focus on the heightened form of individualism, which we think is problematic in the world that we live in today, and you know, to revive communities, to revive this notion of living in peace. We want to try to curtail, you know, violence wherever it is possible. And we want to certainly, you know, to bring to stop the nastiness that humans have and to bring out the goodness.
All that is related to conflict, or rather to resolution of conflict or the ending of conflict. But you deal in conflict transformation. Could you help us define that? You know, how is that different from conflict resolution?
Indeed. Conflict resolution, you know, you usually have an intermediary or a mediator that goes in and tries to resolve the conflict. We believe very strongly that conflict is always there. Okay, it is very much part and parcel of human life, human interactions. So what we try to promote is what we call elicitive conflict transformation. And elicitive conflict transformation goes back to the fundamentals of the lives of the people that who are in conflict. We believe strongly that it is fine not to see eye to eye on a number of different things, because it's very much part of living in the world that we live in. But the problem emerges when you take an eye for an eye, you know, when it becomes protracted violence. So conflict transformation involves the transformation of the negativity in conflict into positive, because sometimes we find that in human history, it is conflict that actually spurs progress. So we have the conflict of the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution that has actually led to the progress that we see in the world today. So conflict may not necessarily be bad.
But how do you get it to be good?
How we get it to be good is through dialogue, okay? That's one. Through sort of attaining deeper understanding. So if people have disagreements, I think it's really important. We believe strongly that we bring people together for them to talk, but not just to talk, but to listen, and compassionate listening in particular. And this involves what we call empathic engagement. So empathy is an extremely important thing. Now, we're not short supply. We don't have empathy is not in short supply. You know, we are human. As humans, neurosurgeons have proven beyond any doubt that there are mirror neurons that trigger this empathy in us. So we are hardwired for empathy. So what actually has happened in society today is that those mirror neurons have been blocked in a number of different ways. The economic systems that we live in, the various kinds of, you know, educational processes, what I call sometimes the era of the selfie, you know, the very much the focus on the individual.
Our modern community structures, some might argue, are actually, precise. Yeah.
Yes, and so what needs changing is that, and to go back to that very strong sense of empathy that we have, and this is where we can, in many ways, you know, transform conflict by bringing people together, getting them to talk, achieve some kind of understanding, not to resolve, but a much deeper understanding of the various kinds of disagreements that they have, but most importantly, to put themselves in the shoes of the other person that they are in conflict with.
How much training does that require, though? Not just for the people who are involved in DEEP, who would be going into, you know, kind of try to mediate this, but also just for people whose default mindset might be, well, you're wrong, and I need to prove that to you somehow. You know, how do you get around that?
Okay. Well, training is important. I mean, the members of DEEP, they're all trained in, you know, elicitive conflict transformation. They are trained in peace building and dialogue and dialogical work. But we believe strongly as well that, you know, humans have this capacity to dialogue, you know, and that we have in many ways, as you mentioned, you know, modern living, in many ways we have lost that capacity in some way. We have, you know, we live in a society where we have become extraordinarily aggressive and, you know, extraordinarily kind of aggrandizing, you know, that we want to push our own, you know, viewpoint. So if you look at traditional societies and communities, we actually find that people have existed through this kind of traditional forms of dialogue, through what I call indigenous forms of conflict transformation. So we can actually, we don't need to carry a manual or a theoretical book of elicitive conflict transformation and then go in and say, you know, according to this book, you know, this is what you need to do, X, Y, Z. We just have to go back to the communities and rekindle, you know, revitalize those indigenous forms of conflict transformation, whether it's the Orang Asli or whether it's, you know, the Kadasan or Malay communities, Chinese or Indians in this country. We find that each of these communities would have had traditional forms of conflict transformation, traditional ways of dealing with conflicts. And I think, you know, it's just a matter of trying to resuscitate, you know, some of these various forms.
I'm speaking today with Alberto Gomez, director of the DEEP Network, in other words, the Dialogue, Emphatic Engagement and Peace Building Network. And that's exactly what we've been discussing and what we'll continue to discuss after this. We'll also be examining why DEEP has chosen to go for a multi-pronged approach. You're listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined in the studio now by Alberto Gomez, director of the DEEP Network, or the Dialogue, Emphatic Engagement and Peace Building Network, which is what we're discussing today. Is DEEP actually an extension of your previous work at the Center for Dialogue at La Trobe University? What similarities or differences are present?
Yes. Well, DEEP builds from the Center for Dialogue. I was the director of the center for 2 years. And some of the projects that we carry out as part of Melbourne DEEP, I should probably explain to your listeners that DEEP is a network of a number of different what we call nodes. We take various kinds of biological sorts of analogies to define DEEP, which makes us, you know, in a way in touch with nature. And these nodes are, you know, located in different parts of the world. So in the Melbourne DEEP, for example, is an extension of what we used to do in the Centre for Dialogue. The Centre for Dialogue in the past was located at a university, and it was driven primarily by research. And although we did engage in a number of projects that focused on, say, you know, international dialogue, Australia-Indonesia dialogue, Australia-Turkey dialogue, and which was, you know, at the international level, track two diplomacy. Now, we also conducted a number of different projects. For example, a very successful project in Australia was what we call the Reconciling Divided Communities, where we have communities that have come and settled in Australia and unfortunately have brought their animosities and their divisions and, you know, their divides from their home countries to Australia. So we have like Hazara and the Pashtuns and then the Palestinians and the Jewish community, and then the Sri Lankan Tamils and the Sinhalese. So what we have done in DEEP, in some of our projects, which was funded by the Victorian state government, was to bring these members of these divided communities and to hold a dialogue, to seek a common ground, you know, in these groups, and to ensure that the kind of animosities or resentment that they held for each other did not then translate into violence of any sort, because Australia is very proud of its multiculturalism and intends to, you know, try to hold on to it as much as it can. So the different nodes in the different parts of the world have different, you know, kinds of focus. So take Zurich, for example. The members of the Zurich node of DEEP, they tend to focus on refugee issues. It's in a European context, you know, refugees have real difficulties in settling in some parts of say in Switzerland. So the ones who are working for the Zurich Note, in fact, they are, you know, focusing on refugee issues and settlement of refugees, changing people's attitudes towards refugees, the dominant population in Switzerland. And then we have the San Francisco Note, for example, is using, you know, improv theater and various kinds of drama to change people's thinking about various issues to do, whether it's to do with ecological issues, but also most importantly to do with conflict transformation. Then we have the Yogyakarta Note, for example, where the focus is on interreligious, interfaith dialogue. So, you know, the different nodes tend to focus on different issues, but you're absolutely right in the sense that what we are doing stems from the Center for Dialogue, but what it makes it different is that it is not just entirely a research institution, but one that is focused on transformative projects.
So with this multi-pronged approach then, from different nodes about different issues, how do you offer help to one another? I mean, that perhaps sounds like a basic question, and yet sure. when you look at the issues that these communities are facing, they're very distinct from one another, and you certainly have to contend with very local concerns. So how can you, as a global network, kind of go, okay, well, here's a learning that we've taken from Zurich that perhaps might be applicable in Jogja?
That's right. What we have done is, thanks to social media and thanks to, you know, the virtual communications that we have at the moment, we have established a number of different working groups and committees. For example, we have a networking committee, and that networking committee has members from different nodes, from different parts of the world. So they network with one another, and what happens is that we use the various projects that take for example Mexico. The focus in Mexico is peace education. So a number of the Mexican members of the Deep Note, what they are engaged in is going to schools and, you know, carrying out workshops. The kind of work that they do then becomes like a spur for the other notes that pick up some of these various projects. And what we are, you know, planning to do is to hold a workshop, an international workshop, where we'll bring all the note directors from different parts of the world together. There is hope that we will try to hold it in Kuala Lumpur. And so any of your listeners are interested, you know, I'm here, if you don't mind me making a plug, you know, for the Deep. And this is one of the ways that we bring everyone together. But at the moment, a lot of our communications is through the various sorts of, you know, Facebook and other forms of social media, email list. We have our own, you know, web page. So there are a number of global, if I can say, aspects of Deep that connects each of the different nodes together. And the first year was spent essentially to establish these various connections. And to the extent that members of Deep don't say that they're just members of an organization, but in fact, it sounds terrible, but we actually say that we are members of a family. And we refer to each other as brothers and sisters, and you know, and among the young you know, colleagues of mine in Deep, they use words like dipsters, you know, fellow dipsters. So, you know, it's an acronym that you know, it's in a way my brainchild. You know, I was thinking of trying to come up with an acronym that would resonate with the young, and it seems that it's picked up. So, you know, Deep has become very much on the lips of many of these young, you know, colleagues of ours, and that's how it's, you know, it's building, and it's grown into, much to my surprise, it has grown into a very large network. But having said that, it's a large network with very small groups of people working, you know, in a kind of a concerted way in local nodes.
Once you've come up with an acronym that lends itself well to a nickname, you've managed this. So from what I'm hearing then, Deep is in favor of a bottom-up process rather than a top-down one.
Precisely.
Does this work best in aid situations? Are there other situations where a bottom-up process is really what's required?
Yeah. The reason we decided on a bottom-up process, if you to use the way you've described it, is primarily because, you know, I've taught in this Peace Masters program in Spain since 2008. And every year I meet, you know, about 20 students in my master's course, you know, absolutely passionate, committed to peace building. And then when they complete their studies, off they go and they work for some large peace organization. And really, unfortunately, you know, many of these large peace organizations are nothing, you know, they in fact, sorry, I shouldn't say nothing, but there is absolutely nothing peaceful that happens in the organization itself, you know. And there's a lot of squabbling that takes place, jealousy, and there is a kind of a very strong hierarchical structure, you know, with a director sort of standing aloof from everyone else. And many of these young, you know, peace activists begin to lose, you know, their strong passion. And so my colleague, you know, Dr. Jennifer Murphy, who is now in San Francisco, was my colleague in Spain. Dr. Michaelis Michael, who is my colleague in Australia. Makiri, who is Dr. Makiri, who is a Maori from New Zealand. And Dr. Barbara Tin. So the sort of older, more experienced people, we decided, you know, let's try to bring these young, you know, young, passionate, committed scholar activists. We bring them together, but, you know, the various things that we promise, one is that the common values that we hold, social responsibility. For example, we will not accept funds from any organization that's involved in the damaging of the environment and damaging of humans. So no mining companies and no tobacco companies. Secondly, we promote very strongly cooperation and collaboration. Thirdly, we promote an inclusive, you know, environment. And most importantly, it is an egalitarian, you know, organization. Even though I'm the, you know, the director by default since I initiated this project, and you know, Jennifer Murphy, who is the person that I, you know, talked about this project, is the deputy director. But however, we do not have a hierarchical structure in a sense that the young cannot come and approach us, and so we you know, strongly adhere to this ethic of egalitarian structure.
You mentioned that you're not going to ask mining companies or tobacco companies for funding. You also said you'll try to avoid asking bankers for funding.
Oh,
so
sorry.
With that gone, where will your sources of funding be coming from?
Yes, I think that, well, we'll accept money from the bankers. I mean, I think in the analogy that I wrote to recruits, you know, members at the time, which was an analogy of the, you know, building of a home, I used bankers there in a metaphorical way. So I
right.
meant bankers in the sense of someone who was going to bank on us, you know, in that sense, and not in the sense that we would not accept money from bankers. So if there are any rich bankers among your listeners, you know, if you're really, you know, concerned about the violence that we find in the world together today, and if you're very concerned about, you know, ecological unsustainable living, then we would love to hear from you.
Moving from the local to the international, Johan Galtung, who's an influential figure in conflict studies, thinks of the US as an imperialist power. Is this a view that Deep shares? Do you tend to see things from the prism of the global South?
Yes, indeed, we do. But however, I think it's not entirely helpful sometimes to take a political stance, I would say, to, you know, respective countries. So perhaps, you know, Professor Galtung is right in his view of, you know, U.S. imperialism as the way he puts it. But however, we also have to take into consideration the fact that there is the U.S. government, but there are, you know, U.S. citizens. And we also have that quite a number of U.S. citizens are totally against, you know, that kind of imperialism that the government tends to, you know, perpetrate in different parts of the world. So the important, well, I agree with, in some way, with, you know, Professor Galtung, but I also believe, and I think he does so as well, because he's one of our advisors. And we believe very strongly that, you know, we have to try to do more at the community level, because, you know, a lot of the changes that are taking place in the world today, whether it's in Greece, for example, or the, you know, very heartening, you know, change of politics, the tide is changing, as they say, in Spain, for example, we find that, you know, people at the community level who are, you know, establishing new forms of leadership, they are challenging, you know, the kind of dominant paradigms, the dominant ideologies. They are, in fact, working, you know, very diligently in terms of bringing people back into the picture of politics. So I think it's just focusing at that international level and at international relations and politics, you know, may be useful in certain, you know, kinds of political discourse, but as far as peace building, dialogue, and conflict transformation, we go back to the very basic, fundamental, you know, levels of communities, and trying to gain as much as possible from the lessons that indigenous peoples have provided, from marginalized communities whose voices have been, you know, not only unheard, muted, but they have also been silenced.
So if you look specifically then at something like the Rohingya conflict, which is right at our doorstep and certainly involves the kind of marginalized voices that you're talking about, how could that be resolved without engaging in the larger political process? How could it be kind of addressed on a community level?
Okay, that's a very good question, and I think something that we are really very concerned about. Now, for us, the people who are seeking refuge, they are, you know, indeed marginalized. And one thing that we need to do is, in terms of the regional process, we have to look at a country like Myanmar, what is actually happening in that country. And I think, you know, this is one of the problems that we have in the world today in terms of how, you know, religion becomes very much part of a division in terms of, you know, it tends to create these divides between different groups of people. So in Myanmar, we have a Muslim, you know, minority and Buddhist, you know, majority. So one of the things we have to try to work out is that, you know, Deep would really like to go to Myanmar, okay? And there has to be, and there are peace organizations, and what we need to do is to try to support those various peace organizations within Myanmar itself to point out, you know, that the Rohingya people are, you know, very much like one of us, you know, and this is where, you know, empathy really works. The fact that they are discriminated, you know, disenfranchised in their own country, the fact that they have been, you know, excluded from Myanmar is primarily, you know, due to the fact that they have been dehumanized. So we have to try to work out ways of how we can rehumanize in the minds of the people in Myanmar. That's the first stage. But the next stage is that it was really sad to see, you know, that the countries in the region, you know, Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, you know, adopting the kind of deplorable, you know, policy of the Australian government in terms of stopping the boats. And, you know, and I don't think that one needs to learn from, you know, countries that are, you know, totally, you know, like Australia, you know, totally irresponsible, you know, in terms of its treatment of people who are seeking refuge.
Conflict resolution and conflict transformation, it's, I think it really is kind of the ultimate aim, you know, it's sort of a, it's the high road, essentially, you know, you're trying okay. to take the high road here in addressing these really contentious issues. But it would seem, at least if you just consume the media, that political players tend to get their way. It feels that way anyway. Mm. When has there been a time when conflict resolution or transformation has really saved the day, so to speak, has really kind of come to the fore?
Okay, if we look right around the world, we find that we tend to put much greater disproportionate, you know, attention in the media or in books, even, you know, academic work on, you know, issues to do with conflict and issues to do with violence. But, you know, whenever we take, for example, Africa, almost invariably, you know, when someone speaks about Africa, it's, you know, focused on some conflict in some part of Africa. But in the whole continent, the number of the incidences of violence and conflict is a very small percentage of the incidences of people living in peace with one another. So the point I'm trying to make here is that there are, in fact, people have very successfully transformed conflict in different parts of the world. In Africa, for example, there's the key African ideology of Ubuntu, that we are, you know, because of all of you, you know, in the sense that the unity of and the solidarity of humans, coming together. I mean, that's an interesting story of in Africa where a teacher in bringing some school kids in a race and said that whoever wins the race is going to get a bag of you know, lollies or sweets. And much to the amazement of the teacher, the kids all held hands and ran the race, and so that everyone reached the finish point, you know, at once. And so they shared the sweets among themselves. Now, this is amazing, you know. It's an amazing ideology, the concept of Ubuntu. But, you know, instead we focus our attention on conflict diamonds rather than the, you know, marvelous, you know, traditional indigenous forms of conflict, you know, management, transformation, I should say, and also, you know, peace building in those communities. So my point here is that, yes, you know, it is the high road, but I don't think so. I think the high road is really, you know, the fact that we're hardwired for empathy. That's where, you know, as a human, you know, it's the high road to peace, eh? And I think this is really important to keep in mind that that, you know, conflict is natural, but however, you know, peace is the norm, and you know, humans have always lived in peace and harmony. As I mentioned earlier, and violence is just an aberration.
Thank you very much for your time, Alberto. I've been speaking with Alberto Gomez, director of the DEEP Network, or the Dialogue, Emphatic Engagement and Peace Building Network, which has been the topic of today's show. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.